Hey guys, welcome back to Ramblings and Remedies. This is Gina. We finally have Sabina back with us. So Sabina, how does it feel to be back?
Hey you guys, it's so good to be back. It's been a couple of busy weeks, but excited to have this conversation with you and Gina.
It has definitely been a busy several weeks. Sometimes life wants to come all at once. But regardless, we are here. We are back, and like we promised, we have been really working hard to bring you guys better content for you. And so we have a lot of different things lined up, new topics and new guests. So I hope you guys look forward to that. And so we are going to be trying out a different segment. This segment focuses on things that we wish we were told before we became adults. There's a lot of different topics, so we're gonna be weaving that in and out of our other segments. So let's get right into it.
So we had initially started this podcast to basically be the best friends you guys always wish you had. And to provide you with some tips and tricks that we've learned along the way as we struggle to navigate becoming young adults.
So the first topic for this new season of the podcast is basically the sex and dating edition. We're now in our early 30s, and we can kind of reflect back on the gaps in our knowledge and what we wish we kind of knew as teenagers and then entering into young adulthood. Important facts and resources, you know, what could have made this a more comfortable journey, even though it is a learning process that's very individual to people. When did you first get exposed to sex ed, Gina?
My first exposure was in high school. I believe it was in 10th grade and very innocent. I know everybody's surprised, but yes, I used to be innocent. But yeah, I really didn't have any information, any knowledge about what sex was. And so it was definitely a shocking experience for me.
I was a little bit younger. I had initially gone to Catholic school where abstinence is what is advocated for. I remember in Catholic CCD, they try to get us to sign a abstinence certificate promising to not engage in sex till we were married.
Oh, wow.
Which is interesting because we really didn't know what sex was. Like, how do you have a child sign a contract that was, you know, spiritually very meaningful without understanding what it was that we were signing, you know? But then I transitioned into public school where they introduced us to the topic of sex. And obviously, as, teenagers and, young preteens, there's, the giggling over, boys and girls and boobs and, lack thereof, right? It's kind of it was interesting. It was the first time we had that cartoon rendition of what sexual intercourse looked like. The teachers were uncomfortable. The students were uncomfortable. The questions that they later let us write out questions on pieces of paper. So even if you were engaging in sex or interested in engaging in sex at that young age, and let me tell you, the average age of sex is young, you know, kids start having sex at a young age, and it is important to make it normal for them to feel comfortable asking questions on how to stay safe. It was a awkward and not particularly informative experience for my introduction to this conversation.
Oh, absolutely. I had the exact same introduction, meaning I went from attending a private Catholic school from elementary till 8th grade, and then transitioning into a public high school. There wasn't any actual scientific information provided during my early years, and then high school happened, and then I'm like, what? A penis? What? A vagina? What? What is happening here? I guess it was a combination of being really shocked and a little bit disgusted, because that was just very new information to me. And like you, that health, sex health education class was probably the most useless class I've ever taken, because I learned nothing except for one thing, that a human being's forearm can fit inside a condom. That is all I learned.
I think I remember that tidbit, or that pretty useless fact, and it was accompanied by if a man's penis is the size of a human being's forearm, run. And I remember the teacher saying that, and we're all like cracking up. But then it's unfortunate because the way the class was taught, the fact that people were so uncomfortable when the teacher did announce that there were instances of STDs cropping up in our school in particular, right? It was almost stigmatized because the way that people were being introduced to sex is, oh my gosh, caution, caution, caution.
Yeah.
If you have sex, this is what's going to happen. You're right. Going to get all these STDs, you're going to get pregnant. It's a very much a fear-mongering conversation. And back then, and like I said, I can't really speak. I don't have children, so I can't really speak for what these classes are like now. But the term that was used, and I'm only really aware of this because of my profession now, the term that was used was safe sex, right? And this is very pertinent, in my belief, this verbiage that's utilized regarding this conversation. There is no such thing as safe sex. The only type of safe sex there is abstinence. But safer sex is the verbiage that they should be utilizing in these classroom settings.
Right.
People are going to have sex. So it's important to be able to have these conversations in an appropriate way and in a open way. So kids, young adults, older adults, I've had older adults ask me questions that I'm like, oh, did you really never know that your whole life?
Right.
So they should be comfortable asking these questions. I mean, I gotta say, I was pretty naive. Like, that random topic, my parents are very, like, old school. I was definitely not having this conversation with them. And because I grew up in such a Catholic household, it was so taboo. It was, like, dating, forget it. Sex, not even on my radar. You know, I just assumed, and it's terrible, I internalized it as, like, a very dirty topic.
Right. If you can't speak about it with your parents, obviously you and I both grew up in a very conservative, you know, Catholic environment. We only had our friends and then our school setting. And our school wasn't really helpful either. And I remember it just the same as you. It was not an environment that was open to having discussion. It was more like finger pointing and blaming and just saying this is going to happen, and instilling fear, saying if you do this, this is what's going to happen to you, so don't do it. That's pretty much what they were trying to tell us, and all in all, it was rather more traumatic than anything else. It wasn't an informational setting, it wasn't a welcoming setting, it wasn't an open setting. It was just pretty much a setting where I didn't learn anything. I sat there and I did other work from other classes. Didn't even pay attention because even though it was new information to me, I already knew from early on it was worthless information.
Yeah. Well, that's like so unfortunate to hear because, like you said, your first exposure to this information was like in 10th grade at the age of 15. And we know that majority of American kids have had sex by then,
right.
You know, and when you say that your alternative access to resource were your friends who are like the same age as you, they're getting the same, most likely the same exposure to accurate information. Like, this is where like these unreasonable expectations or this is where that vulnerability comes from, right? Like, if you don't have a strong enough understanding of your own body and the decisions that you need to make, right? So, I mean, I was the same way. I got the bulk of my information from my friends, my classmates. I would be like traumatized by some of the things that they would say, but that's because it was so taboo back then. I do feel like there's been progress being made in the exposure to information, the openness people have about asking questions about their own bodies. And I really, really appreciate that the topic of consent is now becoming mandatory in these sex ed conversations. I never got told about consent as in when I was first exposed and then when I took health class again in high school. It's such an important detail for ownership of your body that I can't believe it took decades for this to be talked about.
Yes, it's important to understand the anatomy of the body, right? It's important to understand the STDs involved, yes, and what is a condom. But sex is also about, you know, learning about your own identity, how to create healthy sexual relationships with whoever your partners are. But all of that needs to start from somewhere. We need to get information somewhere to be able to take that step to develop all that. And these classes that we were in at the time didn't offer anything like that. And so for now,
it could be our schools. It could be our
absolutely.
Schools. There might be other people who had phenomenal access to resources, but I can say for without a doubt that it was fear-mongering at its best. It was just terrifying. Sex is made to be a taboo, dirty topic.
Yep.
And without outright saying it, they were promoting abstinence.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. So let's go into a little further details then. Okay. So to you, Sabina, what is sex?
Okay. So let me answer that in two parts, right? One, as before I became a provider, and now after many years of being a provider, right? Before I became a provider, my understanding of sex was influenced by my conservative upbringing, right? It was an act that should only be between a husband and a wife. It was a process to have children. Pleasure was considered dirty. Masturbation was never talked about. And part of it is like Catholic guilt, good old Catholic guilt.
Of course.
Premarital sex is off the topic. It was a biological function that was necessary between a man and a woman. That's how I was raised, right? In order to reproduce. A married man and a woman, okay?
Yep. Yep.
Fortunately, by going to a big school, being exposed to many people, I like developed much more liberal comprehension of what is sex. Like, sex can be anything. It doesn't need to be vaginal penetration.
Mm-hmm.
Oral sex is sex, girl. Like, I mean, yes, you can't get pregnant that way, but if your only definition regarding sex is an act in order to conceive, you're missing out on many other acts
yes.
that are just as pleasurable and just as at risk, just as much risk
mm-hmm.
for contracting STIs. How about you? What is your definition of sex?
I think you pretty much nailed it right on the head. Growing up in my household, it was just a biological function to reproduce. Pleasure had nothing to do with it. I only learned about pleasure accidentally. Because I didn't know the term masturbation, but then you start getting curious, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And that's how I learned that there are actually ways to pleasure yourself. And so that's when I learned that, oh, sex can lead to, you know, pleasure. That's the first time I made that connection.
Which is, like, so sad, because not all people want to have children,
yeah.
right? But a lot of people want pleasure, and they want to engage in sex in, like, whatever that capacity is for them. But like I said, we were limited by the environment we grew up on. It's not something to, like, penalize someone if they still hold these beliefs, right? You hope that they don't try and push their beliefs on you.
Right.
No one should be suppressed. I feel like any movement towards equality and access or, like, pleasure or whatever it is that people would like is a movement in the right direction, but not everyone is there for themselves to be able to comprehend that, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so as long as their viewpoints are not limiting and, like, suppressing other people, I'm like, they'll get to there at their own time. They may never get to there. Like, my parents, they've made steps and bounds in progress when it comes to the definition of, like, partners and sexuality. They understand that people engage in sex premaritally. Is it a conversation that's still very uncomfortable for them? Absolutely. Am I about to bring that up when I'm, like, at the dinner table? No, like, that is not happening. But that's okay, right? That's everyone has a boundary, and that's also part of consent,
mm-hmm.
right? Like, and it's part of these conversations that you might have in your workplace about what is appropriate talk, what is not. Just because it's not offensive to party A and B, if party C is witnessing, right?
Yep.
It could be offensive to them, right? I get so many questions when I was working outpatient, and some of these questions that kind of took me by surprise. I didn't understand how lacking the education on people on sex and on how to stay safe and on their own body. Like, there was so much of a gap in this knowledge. And it didn't matter if you were poor, even though the gap of knowledge seemed to be much larger there, right? Or pretty well off. Maybe it's because for these are older generations. We're old now, Gina, as you know. Did you see that? You labeled us old. maybe it's because it was so taboo growing up that people just were uncomfortable asking these questions. But let's get back on track. Like, so the CDC, how is the CDC? This is a great resource for anyone who is interested. The CDC, Planned Parenthood, they have lots of resources. But the CDC, how do they define sex health education?
So they stated that sex health education is the knowledge and skills to help people be healthy and avoid human immunodeficiency virus, or the HIV, sexually transmitted diseases, STD, and unintended pregnancy.
Now let's look at the definition from Planned Parenthood.
Planned Parenthood states that sex education is high-quality teaching and learning about a broad variety of topics related to sex and sexuality, exploring values and beliefs about those topics, and gaining the skills that are needed to navigate relationships and manage one's own sexual health.
I love this definition. Yeah. I can tell you 100% that the courses that I was exposed to in my youth was definitely not high quality teaching. It did not help me understand navigating relationships, and it definitely did not help me understand what was important for my own sexual health.
Right. I love that they started putting in exploring sexuality, because there are so many different identities out there now, and we've only been focusing before on men and women. There was nothing else in between that. And the fact that we are now opening it up, being able to discuss and explore LGBTQ identities and relationships and being more inclusive, makes me really happy.
Me too. I am glad that we're making this knowledge more inclusive. This knowledge base is being broadened, and hopefully more and more people will feel safe in asking questions about what is pleasure, what is healthy, what is not healthy, what is normal, what is not normal, and what is okay for one person is not okay for another person. And this is also important when it comes to people who are healthcare providers. Our knowledge base was very biased towards heterosexual relationships and very, very biased towards our belief that, you know, homosexuality puts you at greater risk for X, Y, and Z. And yeah, maybe there's truth to this back in the day, but there are safer practices now in place to keep all people safe. And we are making progress, and we do need to have these conversations in a more appropriate way. We do need to ask people their pronouns. We need to make them feel comfortable when they come and sit across from you and they are asking you very personal questions. I could tell you, as a healthcare provider, when I'm in the patient seat, I have had horrific encounters with my gynecologist. Horrific. And I remember being so traumatized that here I am, as a healthcare provider, telling you about my sexual practices, my needs, what I'm looking for, and I am getting a very old school answer. Basically, I had an OBGYN tell me not to have premarital sex. And I was like, I hope you're not telling people this. Right. Like, that is not a decision that you make. And now I no longer feel safe asking you things because I don't want to wait for marriage. I don't even know if marriage is in the cards for me.
Right.
So it's unfortunate. The progress is being made. I really feel like the more open we are about conversations like this, no matter how difficult it is, right, it makes it more normal to have these conversations.
Absolutely.
And it forces people to address things that they normally wouldn't.
Right. I agree. Having a provider who's willing to have a conversation with you is really important, because just like you, I had to go through a lot of different GYN providers before I was able to find someone that I was comfortable with to have these conversations. So my first experience with a GYN, she criticized me. She criticized me about having sex. She criticized me about how the shape of my vagina was. She criticized me in a lot of different things. She made me feel very uncomfortable and very not normal. And that what I was doing was wrong. And so after that, I honestly thought, I don't want to go back. I don't want to see another doctor who's going to be like that. And it took me a while to be able to find another provider and be able to open myself again, to be able to really be comfortably asking those questions and having those conversations. And so it makes a big difference on how people, you know, how providers treat you and talk to you.
It does. And I will say that I have a new gynecologist. I'm in my early 30s. And this is the first time I have ever encountered a provider who asks, prior to even meeting them, a huge list of questions on whether you have a trauma background, whether there are any things that you feel that you need in order for this appointment to make you feel safe. You know, sex is a very vulnerable topic, and it is a very vulnerable position, and it's very personal. So you do deserve a person, a provider, whoever that is, who listens to you and understands your needs. And I really personally appreciated that. I remember going through my training in women's health and men's health, right? Sex ed, doesn't matter how you identify. It's important for everyone. That my school benefited us by giving us access to this program, these people who come around and they make asking questions about sex. They'll ask you all sorts of questions because they really want to engage the provider in asking things in the right way, in listening. We need to learn to listen.
Yes.
Right? If you are constantly just putting words in your patient's mouth, if you are telling them things that are based on bias, right? You're closing doors. You're destroying that relationship. They're not going to be open with you. And in the case of people who are listening, who are patients, you deserve a provider who listens. You deserve to feel safe in whatever appointment you go to. You should not feel judged for whatever practices you engage in or whatever gives you pleasure, right? Like, you have a right to be like, this is what I need. This is my background. And can you help me? Or can you guide me on what I best need, right? That's the only way that we'll have these conversations. You are always allowed to speak up. It doesn't matter how aggressive or moody the person that is your healthcare provider may be. You deserve a person who wants to be there and cares for you. Mm-hmm. And if you're not getting that, it's time to get up and find somebody else.
Yep. You're not locked in to that one provider. It is in your absolute right to go and find someone else. And so I didn't know that.
I stayed with the same people for years, despite dreading going to my annual appointment, despite dreading it, right? I was like, I hate this woman. She makes me feel so bad about myself. She doesn't listen to me when I tell her that this is a very traumatic experience for me. And she would make me feel so small. And it reflected on her nurse who would do the intake and like these questions that she would ask me that were very triggering for me. And I would say, please stop asking this. I've already established this with you, right? And it would devastate me. I would go and lay in bed after these appointments for hours.
If you guys are in this situation where you feel uncomfortable, you feel judged with your provider, know that you can absolutely change your provider. Go do your research, go talk to them, and find that person, that provider who will give you the respect you deserve, who will allow you to ask the right questions, be willing to listen, and have a discussion with you.
A short break to hear about our sponsor, Anchor. Now, back to our show.
So another thing that I wish I learned about was birth control pills. I have been on birth control pills probably since I was 23 because my periods were so irregular and it was something to help me have regular periods and menstruation. Later, obviously, once I became sexually active, it was a preventative measure. What I didn't know was just how many risks were involved, just exactly what is birth control pills. And so it was only through my own personal research and talking to friends that I realized there are actually different risks involved, and there are a whole slew of symptoms that you can, you know, go through, that I started really questioning and doing my research to get a better understanding of it.
I just want to establish that, yes, I am a healthcare provider, but I am not anyone's healthcare provider. Things that we're talking about is just to give you information that you can utilize in your appointments with your established providers. So yes, there are many forms of birth control. The birth control pill, there's many types, there are many combinations of hormones. What is best for you is best discussed with your provider. What works for one person does not work for everybody, right? And the efficacy of birth control varies depending on what type of instrumentation you're utilizing. The pill is great, and you have to take it at the same time every single day. But if there are other alternatives like the IUD, the implant, a shot. So it really depends, like, what is most effective for you and the risks and the benefits of each type. No, they're not discussed in school, right? This is not talked about in school.
Not at all.
Because ultimately, at least my experience and what Gina's experience was, they were essentially advocating for abstinence. So if you're advocating for abstinence, why would these conversations even come up? And like Gina said, there are multiple reasons for utilizing birth control. In her sense, initially, it was not to prevent pregnancy, but was utilized to regulate for periods, which is a common reason people are on the pill, right? It is utilized in different ways based on what your medical need is. That's like an essentially a huge topic. It's very personal. Everyone has different beliefs on what is appropriate for them. For me, I utilized the pill for many years. I came off of it. It really just wasn't the best fit for me. I was very moody. I was not the best person to utilize something at the same time every day. I am someone who is much better at something like an IUD or an implant or a shot, just because I am not the most compliant person. I forget without an alarm on my phone to take something at the same time every day. That's just my personal experience with the pill.
I recently got off the pill, and my mood swings have 100% improved. But yes, it definitely wasn't for me. I was told by my previous providers that this was the only thing for me. Pills was the only best option for me. There was no other options out there, pretty much. The discussion of IUDs and shots were never really discussed with me. I got off the pill because my current provider, who's great, he's an awesome doctor, he did explain everything to me, and he said that welcome to talk about the IUDs if I wanted it, but I myself didn't want to pursue that route anymore. So he said, we can get off of it, but if you want to, we can always come back and discuss it. So that's where I am now personally, because that's just where I want to be at right now. And so it really does go back to being able to discuss with your provider just what the best option and route is for you.
And like I said, my fallacy is I am not someone who is great at taking something at the same time every day. My previous providers, they would not respect or acknowledge that, right? But my current one does. Like, she understands that this is not for me. I don't take medications. I don't have any need to, right? But when I was taking the pill, I was obviously not taking it in the best, most effective way that it's recommended. And if you don't take birth control in the way it is prescribed, exactly how it's prescribed, it decreases the efficacy against pregnancy, right?
Right.
And so you really do need to discuss with your provider what may be possible limitations for you, in addition to your medical background. But you're right, that's a great conversation, Gina. Like, the types of birth control was never really gone into until I went back to grad school.
Yeah.
And then I was like, oh, look at all these alternatives that may be a better fit for me.
Right. And also, Sabina, birth control pills, just because you take them doesn't mean it protects you against STDs, right?
No, it does not. There's 100% fallacy that the pill... So it's a false information. If someone tells you taking the pill is all you need and you don't need a barrier method, to prevent or reduce the risk of STIs. Oh, also STDs is an antiquated term for STIs. Better word terminology to utilize is STIs, or sexually transmitted infections, okay? So condoms reduce the risk, absolutely. But there are other types of sexually transmitted infections that can pass regardless of condom use. Does it reduce your risk? Absolutely. But there are types like herpes and HPV that pass from skin-to-skin contact. And the condoms really don't do much in the sense of eliminating that risk, though they can reduce that risk. And there are contraceptives and there are sexual barrier methods for both people who identify as male and people who identify as female, or in between. You have to utilize what is best for you. Outside of like birth control, medications or contraceptive utilization of barrier methods, yes, we were not really taught that in high school, right? I don't remember having this conversation. But we were also not educated on how to have conversations with your partner regarding their sexual history, your sexual history. We are seeing in like movies and on television, getting caught up in the heat of the moment, and it looks and feels amazing. But, you know, how do you truly make an informed decision, right? How do you consent to something if you don't have all the information, right? Or if you don't provide the person you're with all the information? People should have the right to choose what they want to engage in, and they can only do that if they are truly provided with all the facts of the person that they're with, right?
Absolutely.
I do believe people need to be open with their sexual history. There is no stigma against how many partners you've had, right? This myth of promiscuity, like, stop. You can get an STI from having just one partner, okay? You can have an STI from having just one partner, and you could have no STI exposure or no STIs from having multiple partners. There is obviously greater risk of coming across STIs, like HPV, for instance. So many people in the world have had contracted or been exposed to HPV, but it's like humans are basically Wolverine. They're pretty much amazing. They are able to really fight off. Most people are able to fight off HPV, right? Yes, there are many different variants. Some can put you at risk for genital warts. Some can put you at risk for developing cancer. But for the most part, the human body is pretty impressive. Another STI that is very common is like herpes, right? When people make fun of herpes in the media so much, but did you know how many people have herpes? and the reason I'm talking about these two STIs in particular, is because we have had conversations with friends who were pretty naive to the fact that if you have cold sores, that's a type of herpes. If you have oral herpes and you're engaged in oral sex with someone, you can give them genital herpes. Many people, and the most common symptom of things like HPV and herpes is that there are no symptoms. And guess what? When I order an STD panel or STI panel, when you come in for your annual check, I am not testing for HPV. One, there's no test for that for men. There's only a pap smear for women, right? And I'm definitely not testing for herpes unless you show up with lesions. You know, I'm not testing you for that. So it's not the recommendation by the CDC to do so. So when you come in for an STI test and they're like, oh, you're negative for anything, sure as hell does not mean you're quote unquote clean. Okay. So please stop like judging people who may or may not know their status. Just because you haven't been tested for something doesn't mean you're in the clear, right? And just because you have tested positive for one of these doesn't mean you're in the minority. There are a lot of people walking around with one or both. And part of this conversation is STDs or STIs, I'm sorry, I'm still getting used to the correct terminology. Our exposure to it were these horrific pictures and these fear-mongering tactics that our high school taught. And that is okay. At the time, that is okay, right? But progress is made and people are engaging in sex and things are changing, and people need to understand that if someone happens to be an STI carrier, that does not define them as a person.
Absolutely.
Doesn't define them. It's just one piece of the puzzle, right? So for my patients who are devastated by diagnosis, I'm like, there is so much more you bring to the table. Yeah. And there is so much baggage a human being can bring to the table in a relationship. So, but it is still very important for you to discuss your sexual history and your health history before you engage in sex with someone else. Everyone has a right to make a decision based on informed consent. But this is something that I wish that we talk about, that just because you have no symptoms doesn't mean you are in the clear, yeah. Right? The most common symptom for an STI is no symptom,
right?
Which is why testing is really important. You should always know your status.
I love that you brought all this up because it is really so important. And I know personally friends and acquaintances who really have no idea, and they really are ignorant to all this information.
Yes, technically the onus is on the individual to put in as much dedication as they want, but it's unfair for someone who doesn't work in healthcare, and even for healthcare providers who don't work in settings like primary care or gynecology, urology. Like, if you're not exposed to this population or specifically to these tests, it's hard to stay up to date on, like, what the literature says. And it's unfair for people in, like, the general public. If they're not being taught this, why would they think to ask these questions? If you don't know this information or have a general idea of the basics, why would you not question when your doctor says, do you want STD testing, STI testing, right? Why would you not assume they're testing you for everything, right? Your doctor should tell you that when we generally do a standard STI panel, it usually only covers chlamydia, gonorrhea, HIV, and syphilis, right? We are not testing for the whole gamut of STIs. And if you want more information, I really think you should be accessing amazing resources like Planned Parenthood, CDC. And then I actually am friends with the owner of a website who I think is doing amazing. Well, I consider her my friend. We talk once in a while. But she is a great resource, and she's really working on destigmatizing people who have STIs or people who have fear of STIs. And her website is called the STI Project, Breaking the Stigma. Yes, it is filled with amazing stories of people who actually have contracted different STIs. But it also kind of breaks down the fact that, hey, it's really easy to contract one. And there's no reason for you to, like, beat yourself up for it. There's no reason for you to feel like you're in the minority. You're not, right? And these discussions need to be had. It helps us break down the stigma against sex, right?
Yeah.
It makes sex normal, because it is. The population did not get to where it is. Because people are not having sex, right? We assume so much as healthcare providers that the person sitting across from us knows a lot.
Yeah.
And you know what? You know a lot about yourself, but you may not know a lot about things like this. And it is okay for you to have these moments. You're like, oh my gosh, I'm in my 40s. How did this happen, right? But then this is where we educate and we talk to you about it, right? And this is why education and talking about sex is really important. I've had so many patients go, is this normal? Because they don't know what a normal vagina looks like. Yeah. They grew up in a very conservative household and they've had a conservative family. So they're not comfortable even talking to, like, siblings or friends about what is normal, right? So the more we talk about this, as uncomfortable as people may be, the more it helps people who are terrified to talk about this, right? And it gives them power. It gives you so much power if you know more about your body, right? And it makes it easier to make decisions. And I wish that these conversations were had and that we were exposed to this information in a way that makes sense. Like, you know, like, I don't think my 15-year-old brain was anywhere near able to understand what I'm learning now, right? It would have helped me. It would have helped my friends. It would have helped people that I know, right, make better decisions, or at least decisions that they were willing to engage in risk in, right? Because the benefit was there. But yeah, this is, like, one of those topics that I kind of wish that we knew before we became adults.
I see so many people close to me who are uncomfortable talking about it, who don't have that conversation with their partners, and a simple conversation, well, I don't want to say simple, but a conversation of, what do I like in sex? You know, what kind of activities do I like? What activities do I not like? Have you ever had an orgasm? What is an orgasm? How to say no all these things, like, they're just uncomfortable talking about it. And so they just, quote-unquote, go with the flow because they don't want to, you know, lose their partner or have their partner lose interest in them. And that makes me really sad, which is why, you know, I say this to my friends all the time. Talk about it. Be selfish in bed. You need to, you know, explore yourself, understand yourself. And so
I mean, Gina's been saying this since college. Before I became a nurse, before I became a nurse practitioner, she was always saying that women need to advocate. Men need to advocate. People need to advocate for what they like and don't like. They need to set boundaries. They need to be comfortable saying no. They need to be comfortable saying, hey, I need this, right? And she's always been saying that. Regardless, I think even when we're like ordering food, you're like, girl, you need to ask for what you want.
In anything you do, it's you need to know where your own personal boundaries lie. And I was such an advocate for everybody to be able to vocalize, you know, what you want and what you don't want. It's so important, and it becomes so extra important when you start engaging in sexual activity, because it's such a vulnerable time. And as much as you say you're not going to be emotionally connected, there's still emotion involved, there's still relationships and things involved, and you want to make a connection, you want to be make sure that it's a safe place to engage in that activity.
Yeah, and also, there is no shame in whether you found pleasure in something, didn't find pleasure. It is, and don't chase the orgasm. Like, don't chase it. Performance anxiety is a thing. Men, women, it doesn't matter. If you are stressed about this, you're not going to enjoy it.
Yeah.
And, like, understand that this is a process. You will learn what you like. You'll learn what you don't like. You might change what you used to like. You may not like anymore, right?
Yep.
Right? And your boundaries might expand. And that these are all okay things, right? But because these conversations have not really progressed in the public in the way that, you know, it's not as accessible. These conversations are hard to have, and it's okay. Like, all of this is a learning process, but the most important thing is, if you are to make a decision, it is important to be informed. And if you need to do something or ask something, you have a right. Like, whether it's with your healthcare provider, whether it's the partner that you're going to be having sex with, right? Like, you have a right to advocate for your need. It's uncomfortable, but the more you do it, the easier it gets.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. I think you should never be shamed. You should never feel guilty, because it is your body, and how you want to feel and what you want to do, that is your own decision. And if somebody, whether it's your provider or your partner, can't respect that, that is a big problem, and that needs to be addressed now.
We promised you that we would be these friends that you can talk to about anything, who will talk about anything. We had growing pains. We still have growing pains. We're still figuring things out. So we want to be having these difficult conversations, these awkward conversations, these uncomfortable conversations. We grew up in a very conservative household. We are the children of Asian American immigrants. If there is anything that we understand, it is being uncomfortable, asking questions, and advocating for yourself. It is not the norm in our culture. It is not the norm in our families. So we want to be a source of change. We want to make this okay for people in our communities, other communities, to be like, hey, like, I have these questions, and I don't know if this is okay, and I don't know who to go to. There are so many resources, yes. Right? And there are so many people in the same boat as you. I promise you, a question that you have is being thought of or has been asked by someone else, yeah. Right? So it is okay. There is no stupid question when it comes to your health. There is no stupid question when it comes to advocating for your pleasure, right? Like, you are allowed to be you're allowed to be selfish,
yes.
Right?
Yes.
Gina says it all the time. Like, be selfish, girl. And it's okay, right? So we will be having more heavy topics like this, interspersed with some, like, fun topics.
All our topics, we will be linking the resources that we mentioned. If you guys ever have any questions or you really want to talk about it, reach out to me. I have my social media linked at all times. So have a conversation with me. Come talk to me, you know, and I will direct you to the best possible resources so that you can have a more detailed and proper conversation with the appropriate people. Because this is important, this is our bodies, this is our life, and we want to do right by it. And Sabrina and I both are really excited about the direction this podcast is going in. We really want to have these conversations with you. And as always, guys, thank you for listening, and please subscribe to wherever you listen to your favorite podcast.
And never forget, there are friends, there is family, and then there is us. Until next time, bye.
Bye.